This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it's Live and Learn, I'm Chua Eun Teck. The family dispute going on between Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong and his two younger siblings show no signs of abating. I wanted to find out the inner workings at the top echelons of the PAP government. My guest today, Michael Barr, is uniquely qualified to talk about this. He is an Associate Professor of International Relations at Flinders University and whose most recent book is The Ruling Elite of Singapore, Networks of Power and Influence. I began the conversation on Michael's characterizations of the late Lee Kuan Yew as a man who adores the admiration of his peers. In cabinet, he surrounded himself with agreeable junior ministers the moment he is able to in the 80s. And in school, he wrote that Lee Kuan Yew rarely had any friends his own age, preferring instead to surround himself with younger students he can dominate. I asked him whether this is consistent with the wish for his house on 38 Oxley to be demolished lest it be turned into a monument.
Oh, I see his wish regarding the house as being slightly different to that. In terms of personality, he needs to dominate, or he needed to dominate. And this is a lifelong trait. Hence, as you say, at school he hung around with boys who were younger than him. He made sure that once he had the chance, he had a cabinet that was beholden to him. And people being beholden to him in subordinate positions is a very consistent pattern, and that goes all the way down the line. But regarding the house, I think it's actually different. He really did not want that tumble down old place, as I understand it, to be, you know, to be his monument. And he's, you know, everyone who does a will is trying to have their way and express their wishes as to what they want done with their worldly goods and how they wish to be remembered, and that's what he's doing there. I don't see any very deep significance with the notion that he wanted to see the house bulldozed. One of the things that is significant is that he wanted Wei Ling, his daughter, to be looked after. One of the things he was insisting on was that she is allowed to live there for as long as she wants, and then after that, it becomes demolished. And you've got to remember that Wei Ling cared for both her mother and her father. She's a classic daughter who never married and cares for the old folks, and he was repaying that. And one of the extraordinary things is that Lee Hsien Loong appears to be wanting to move her out of the home of her own home, and that I find odd.
In reading the book, you challenged the two central tenets of the Singapore story, that it is multiracial and that it is one that is relentlessly meritocratic. Can you tell us why?
The Singapore system of governance and of elite regeneration has been very cleverly put together so that all of the trappings of modernity to do with competitiveness, impersonal bureaucracy, promotion by merit, all of those things are used as a disguise for the exercise of personal power and the dispensation of personal patronage. It has also been used as a disguise for good old-fashioned racism. The dominance of the Chinese within the inner circles of the national elite, which you can see by the pattern, particularly in the military, but by the pattern of scholarship winners, scholarship holders, which are the people who rise to the highest levels, is unambiguous. The utter dominance of the Chinese there is far beyond the proportion of the population. But it is also sustained by inbuilt biases and extra resources being pumped in at times like at things like the primary level and the secondary level and even kindergarten. And once you get a meritocracy that doesn't start off with a level playing field, what you get is the entrenchment of an existing elite in the position of dominance, and that's what you have here. So what we end up with is a system that looks like it's based on a meritocracy because they have exams and they echo multinational companies' promotion and review procedures. It looks like it's multiracial because, and let's give him credit, you know, you have people, very clever people like Tharman Shanmugaratnam as being part of the picture. And yet, in all of this, the outcomes are being determined much more by features like someone's race, someone's socioeconomic background, the privileges they got early in life, who they know, who they have worked with, who they're related to. One of the things that's coming out in this latest saga is the importance of the family and who you're married to, and people throwing their weight around. I'm thinking now of He Qing, Li Xing's wife, throwing a weight around, really on the basis that she is the prime minister's wife. This is not how a modern, impersonal bureaucracy is supposed to work. So we have a foundational myth for the country based upon multiracialism and based upon meritocracy. And in each of those cases, it's a falsehood. There are elements of multiracialism there. There is a type of multiracialism. And there is certainly an overlay of meritocracy, and there is some truth in that. But neither of them really work. There's a Chinese-centric multiracialism, and it is a meritocracy that integrates itself with patronage and with the privileging of people who are already part of or children of an existing elite.
This edifice is kept together because, as you alluded earlier, they are able to perform, isn't it? They consistently rank among the highest in rankings for healthcare and education, transport and housing, so on and so forth. And so, can it be argued that the system works?
Well, it is argued that the system works, and it has to be acknowledged and needs to be acknowledged that the Singapore system does deliver a lot. Its health system is good. Its education system is good. In fact, its education system has aspects that are at the top of world class, especially in the teaching of mathematics. They have done a lot of those things very well. Now, one of the questions you ask is whether the way that it was done was necessarily the best way. And you also ask how much of the winning of awards and how much of them being regarded as being the best is in fact genuine. Because at so many levels, part of the success of the Singapore model is its control of information and its control of its branding. Part of the reason that they run such a tight authoritarian ship in Singapore is because this is part of their branding to the world. They're not just controlling what their own people are thinking, although there are elements of that. They are controlling how the world views them. The very fact that Singapore rates so well under Transparency International rankings, that is, about corruption, is interesting because transparency ranking is based upon perceptions of incorruptibility. It's not actually based upon corruptibility or incorruptibility, it's perceptions of it. And the Singapore government is a master at creating perceptions. The other thing that needs to be acknowledged is that how many advantages that the Singapore government started off with because of Singapore's history. I'm talking about its history before the current regime before independence, and because of its strategic location and its harbour, it has used, the Singapore government has very cleverly used every advantage, every natural advantage, every historical and geopolitical advantage that it has, and that is inherited from the British, and that the British before them inherited from the Malays. It has used that to its advantage to build a war chest. It has made itself a centre for trade, a centre for maritime hubs. It has become an air hub. A lot of this has been because of where they are and because of the history that they just said, thank you very much, we'll take this. Now, they've taken those advantages and used them to make money and to build a war chest, and they have used that war chest to provide a lot of social goods that otherwise they couldn't afford. And they were able to do this while the rest of the region was still struggling with decolonization, with wars, and they were able to build a lot of this during the late colonial period to keep ahead of everyone else. And one of the things that they've been doing, working very hard at doing over the last 20 years, is trying to keep ahead of, for instance, Malaysia and, for instance, Indonesia. Because as soon as these other regional powers start catching up, then Singapore doesn't work so well and doesn't pay its way so well. And that'll make it harder for them to keep providing these goods and being at the top of the tree. And one of their worries at the moment is that for the last decade or more, the country has not been travelling well, its administration has not been pristine, and standards are slipping. And they're actually worried because they're facing new competition from all over the place, from Dubai, as you know, in terms of being an air hub, from Port Klang. These are new challenges, and they are struggling to meet them. At the same time, as they are struggling to meet their own infrastructure needs within the country, and that's causing a lot of domestic unhappiness and political problems. And when you have an authoritarian state that has domestic political problems and public opinion issues, then you know that they're in trouble. It's bad enough when democracies have trouble dealing with their own constituents, but when you get that sort of discontent in an authoritarian state, things must be bad.
That was Michael Barr, author of The Ruling Elite of Singapore. I'll ask him how this family feud has damaged the Lee Hsien Loong brand after the break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Eun Teck. My guest today is Associate Professor Michael Barr, a keen observer of Singaporean politics and author most recently of The Ruling Elite of Singapore. I asked him why, despite his analysis of how the PAP's merit-based legitimacy has been eroding in the public's eye, it still did better in the 2015 elections compared to the elections in 2011.
2015 election was the comeback for the People's Action Party after their terrible showing in 2011. But you've got to remember that they didn't actually claw back that many seats. One seat, I think, they managed to claw back from 2011. They still did not get back Al Junior group representative constituency. They still did not get back Hau Gung. So those groups, those electorates that consolidated them, that voted against the PAP in 2011, still voted against it in 2015. It has to be said that the PAP increased its vote by 10%, taking it from 60% to 70%, approximately, in 2015. And I see this as being a flight to safety by a lot of people who looked to not so much this government, but the memory of Lee Kuan Yew, the founding father, in inverted commas, looked to him for their security. And there was a very real sense in which the vote for Lee Hsien Loong was a vote for, in fact, a thank you, not a vote for, a thank you to his father for all that he had done. And Lee Hsien Loong and the PAP of 2015 capitalized on this shamelessly. The affection, well, I don't know if affection is the right word, the respect that was manifest towards Lee Kuan Yew in the week-long funeral and mourning that took place at the end of March and the beginning of April 2015, the ubiquitous presence of his image and of his words during the 50th anniversary celebrations, and then which took place just a week or two before the general elections, and then the sort of the virtual presence of Lee Kuan Yew in general election as well. This brought about a tremendous upsurge of nostalgia and an upsurge of respect for Lee Kuan Yew that Lee Hsien Loong capitalized on. And this is one of the things that his brother and sister are complaining about, that he has taken it upon himself to husband the brand, the Lee Kuan Yew brand, and to use it to help the Lee Hsien Loong brand. Because the Lee Hsien Loong brand by itself represents a lot of policy failures and several apologies. You've got to remember that they won the 2011 election and didn't do any worse than they did because Lee Hsien Loong apologized for all the things that the government had done wrong and all the mistakes they had made. That's the sort of associations we have with Lee Hsien Loong. That is the Lee Hsien Loong brand. But the Lee Kuan Yew brand is completely different to that. Much better, much better. So that's part of the reason why we have such a turnaround in 2015. Apart from the fact that they were keeping bad news stories out of the papers, it turns out that all the way through the 50th anniversary celebrations in 2015, and all the way through the general election of 2015, there were people dying from an hepatitis C outbreak in Singapore General Hospital. And they kept that entirely secret. Nothing came out about that until afterwards. That, I'm sorry to say, is the hallmark of a very seriously efficient and effective authoritarian state. That level of control of information is depressing, but impressive.
You subsequently wrote that there is a decline in Singapore exceptionalism as well as the brand of the House of Lees. If this analysis is correct, then would it be true that the 2015 elections is an aberrant in the trends of declining popular vote as well as seat gains in the PAP performance?
Now, this is an interesting question because my reaction to the 2015 elections was that this is a sign that the Singapore electorate will trust the PAP because they're trusting the Lee brand, and that the personal affection and respect for not Lee Hsien Loong personally, but Lee Hsien Loong as a representative of his father meant that the Singapore government can do almost no wrong in the eyes of their electorate. Their electorate might complain about it, but ultimately they will put their trust in what they're familiar with and with these patrons called Lee that they have trusted for 50 years. Now that is what I mean by piggybacking, Lee Hsien Loong piggybacking on his father's brand. Now there is another line of thought that the 2015 elections was an aberration simply because there were so many factors that played there that can never play again. Lee Kuan Yew's death and his funeral, I hesitate to use the word celebrations, but it was almost a celebration in March. The SEAC Games, the 50th anniversary, and of course the election was held just weeks after the 50th anniversary celebrations. Those things can't be reproduced. So they were one-off. And it only actually takes a relatively small number of people to bring about a swing anyway in a small constituency like Singapore. But there is a line of thought that these things being one-off, we can regard the 2015 election as an aberration, and that the downward electoral spiral of the government will continue, especially if its standards of politics, standards of administration don't pick up. The other thing that the Singapore government has been doing has been pouring money into what they call the pioneer generation, which is basically a sort of a cut-down welfare state for the elderly and the poor. And they will keep doing this for as long as they can, but it remains to be seen how long that they will keep doing it. Now, let's just wait and see. I think that the PAP, the government, will continue to pull some rabbit out of the hat at every election. I do not see their electoral appeal, their electoral success, slipping to the point where it disappears, where they lose an election anytime very soon. It could be decades away. And decades away is too long away to be sort of speculating. So we will wait and see. Was it an aberration, or was it the 2015 election an aberration, and they're not going to pick up, so that they will go into another decline, or was it a sign that almost no matter what they do, they will manage to win and pull through? I'm not sure about that. I think we'll have to wait and see.
Since the 2015 election, have you seen any changes in the way that the government is replacing their elite talents in terms of recruitment or in terms of grooming the next generation of leaders?
Very little, actually. There have been changes, but the changes were in place before 2015. In fact, they were in place before 2011. One of the things that happened is that deadwood is less welcome. There was a lot of deadwood around in cabinet in 2011, and that's gone now. But you talk about the changes to their recruitment. One of the big changes has been the channeling of their potential stars, their potential cabinet, through government-linked companies to diversify their experience. Once upon a time, almost everyone came through the mainstream public service, civil service. And then it started changing with the Lee Hsien Loong generation. And then we had their elites being channeled through a combination of the civilian civil service and the military. So we get a lot of SAF, former SAF officers in cabinet, and we have that. Now we have another one where they're coming through the government-linked companies, which they think of as being exposure to private enterprise. But of course, it's not private enterprise at all. It's state enterprise. But nevertheless, it is experience in business. And quite often, it's experience in international business. So that's changed. But if we count the government-linked companies as being part of government, as opposed to being private, and I think we must, then we still have almost every member of cabinet coming through the public sector. And that hasn't changed. That hasn't changed in decades. And I don't think that is going to change, because if they did, they would actually be disturbing the pathway that brought themselves to power.
In your book, The Ruling Elite of Singapore, you begin it with this quote from a speech that Lee Kuan Yew gave to a small group of educators, I think it was the principals, that he was very afraid of the future of Singapore because a very thin crust of leaders, he put it at 150,
yes,
and that he's very obsessed with this idea of, and make no apologies about creating an elite group of people. Where did he get this idea from, that there are people who are just naturally more talented than other people, and these are the people that will be able to drive Singapore forward?
That's a good question. Where did it originate from? Ultimately, I think it originated from looking in the mirror and from the sort of the adulation that his mother gave him. He knew from a very early age that he was special and that he was very bright. And he was determined to see that he would be in a position of power and of privilege. And he brought that about. He was successful. He's also managed to come up with an idea that the Chinese are better. And because he flourished in a multiracial environment, Raffles Institution, and did very well there, came out eventually at with the top score at the end of primary school across the whole of Malaya, and having flourished himself in a multiracial environment, and he being Chinese, somehow he's managed to translate that into a lesson about the Chinese being better. And there are various speeches that he's given where this has become obvious. This is where he's said this in as many words. The theoretical underpinnings of his attraction to this sort of elitism comes from people like Arnold Toynbee, the British historian, who wrote extensively about what he called the creative minority, which is another word for an elite, a ruling elite. He also learned, I believe, an awful lot of this from his time in England, where he was at Cambridge University, and he was mixing with the elites of another country. But, you know, that reinforced this. It is tempting to say that he has picked up on the traditional Chinese notions of an educated elite and Chinese notions rule by your betters. But he wasn't actually exposed to very much of that as a child or even as a young adult. That really came later. Now, I think his exposure to himself and his mother's confidence in him was probably the seminal factor. And then that was reinforced by his years in education, where he continued to be amongst the best, amongst the brightest. And then he went to England and saw a class system at work. And I think it's those sort of mixture of personal and theoretical underpinnings. But really, it's personal. The theoretical underpinnings that he brought to it, and he did, they really were rationalizations of something that he already believed in his heart of hearts, and that he learnt from his own life experience and from the world that he was living in.
Has there ever been such a
drastic split in the ruling elite in Singapore? And two, historically, is there any lessons to learn from what happens after such a split in the authoritarian ruling elite?
You're speaking now of the fractures in the family, are you?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Well, of course, there has been a split, and that was in the 1960s, where the People's Action Party broke wide open. But that was still at a point where the national elite was being formed around Lee Kuan Yew. At that point, he was just one force amongst two, and only one person amongst many. If we're going to start judging the elite as having been really formed only in the 1970s or the 1980s, when you'd say that Lee Kuan Yew was at the top of his game, then the only comparable period of a split that I can think of was the push by Goh Chok Tong to try to push the Lees out in the 1990s. The pilot pushed out Lee Hsien Loong and Lee Kuan Yew. But that was a intra-cabinet intrigue and an intra-civil service intrigue. It was all done behind closed doors. No one knew about it. So I think what we're seeing now is much more spectacular and much more serious than that. The other possible point which you might say that there was a split in the elite was the early 1980s and late 1970s, when there was friction between some populists in the PAP and in cabinet, and Lee Kuan Yew. But at that stage, Lee Kuan Yew was still building up his power base, so I wouldn't count that. Now, if we look at what's happening now, it's hard to see how it's going to bring Lee Hsien Loong down or break open the cabinet, or of course splits, or anything like that. When I wrote my book on the ruling elites of Singapore, I finished up with speculation as to what it would take for the government to fall, what it would take for the regime to change, and I came to the conclusion that the only thing that would be likely to do it would be a split in the elite, such as we had seen in Taiwan, and which in their case brought about democracy. My conclusion was that there was no sign of that happening in Singapore, and it was extremely unlikely to happen. What I did not count on was a split within the family itself. So this has caught me by surprise. I mean, there was a manifestation of it earlier in the year, back in April, with Li Weiling making her complaints public at that time. But the split that we're seeing now is very serious, not for the danger of Lee Hsien Loong losing control, but what it does is it besmirches the Lee Hsien Loong brand, and it may have the effect of spoiling the entry of Lee Hong Yi, that is Lee Hsien Loong's son, into politics, because this has brought the political ambitions of Lee Hong Yi to the front, literally to the front page in Singapore. And this was not supposed to happen. And he's been associated with all of this messiness and this family grubbiness about the house. And he's associated with his father. So it may actually be a turning point in the future of the Lee dynasty. We have to wait and see about that. But I don't see this directly impacting on Lee Hsien Loong in terms of damaging him. There will be damage. There'll be damage to his image. He will possibly never be quite regarded the same way, but he'll still stay Prime Minister for as long as he wants. Cabinet has rallied around him. Cabinet is solid behind him. There is no internal challenger. What it does is, I believe, endanger, if not end, the political ambitions of his son. So that damage to sort of the Lee brand in the long term, I think that's a realistic scenario.
That was Michael Barr, Associate Professor of International Relations at Flinders University and author of The Ruling Elite of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.